Welcome once again to our second series on intelligent design and biological evolution debate. Our guests, as usual, are theologian and scholar in residence and philosopher in residence is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High history and religion, and also government, I believe, Ron?
Sometimes,
okay. And I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church here in Terre Haute, Indiana. Ron, welcome once again. We spent quite a bit of time last session on the theory of evolution and the philosophical basis of this ID, or intelligent design, argument. And now we'd like to talk about intelligent design from a scientific level. Philosophical is more what we could conclude from the facts about there has to be a designer if there is design. But we're just going to talk about, if there's a watch, there has to be a watchmaker. We're going to talk more about the scientific level of intelligent design. So could we begin with that on our program today?
Well, let me begin by defining intelligent design as a science. As you just suggested there, we spent the first session taking a look at intelligent design as a philosophy, as we had spent a lot of time on our series, Reasons to Believe Catholic Apologetics. From a scientific point of view, at least from the perspective of intelligent design proponents, that is, those who are for it, intelligent design is the view that certain features of the universe and of living things can best be accounted for by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as genetic mutation and natural selection that we discussed, you know, in our last session when we were talking about the theory of evolution. Intelligent design scientists look for existing empirical or observable evidence that implies life on Earth must have been designed by an intelligent agent or agents. William A. Dembski, that's D-E-M-B-S-K-I, who is one of the leading proponents of intelligent design, says that the most important claim of intelligent design is that, quote, there are natural systems that cannot be adequately explained in terms of undirected natural forces, and that exhibit features which in any other circumstances we would attribute to intelligence, end of quote. Leading advocates of this view claim that intelligent design is a scientific theory equal or even superior to current scientific theories regarding the origin of life. That is, you know, the theory of evolution. The leading advocates of intelligent design are affiliated with an organization called the Discovery Institute.
Okay, I think I and many other people have never heard about the Discovery Institute, although it has some very prominent people connected with it. But I think you have to kind of be into this controversy to be acquainted with it. Tell us something about the Discovery Institute.
The Discovery Institute is a nonprofit educational foundation. It's a think tank founded in 1990 and is located in Seattle, Washington. The stated mission of the organization is to, quote, make a positive vision of the future practical, end of quote, and we'll find out what they mean by practical as we go into our discussion here. It's the main promoter of intelligent design in this country, but it does have other interests, such as transportation and telecommunications policy, international cooperation in the Pacific Northwest, and things of that sort. They're primarily concerned with the area around Seattle and Puget Sound. Among other things, it conducts legislative lobbying and testimony, public conferences and debates, media coverage. It produces its own publications and conducts aggressive lobbying to influence public opinion. And interestingly, it focuses upon the Christian apologetics of C.S. Lewis. It was founded as a branch of the Hudson Institute, which is an Indianapolis-based conservative think tank and is named after the Royal Navy ship HMS Discovery, that is the Discovery Institute is, in which George Vancouver, which of course you know the city of Vancouver, Vancouver Island.
Named after him?
Yes. He explored Puget Sound in 1792. The Institute's founders are a man by the name of Bruce Chapman and George Gilder, both critics of the anti-intellectualism, or at least the alleged anti-intellectualism of the Republican Party during the Goldwater and the Reagan years. Edward Meese III, that was a name, if you remember that period, during the Reagan years, Reagan's top advisors, in fact, a former Reagan advisor, is among its most noted members of of the Discovery Institute. In 1996, Chapman, Gilder, and a man by the name of Stephen C. Meyer secured financing from Howard Amundsen Jr. and the McClellan Foundation to fund the Center for Science and Culture, which becomes a branch of the Discovery Institute. And it's through this organization that most of this ID work is being done.
Okay.
Not directly through the Discovery Institute as much as this other branch that was founded called the Center for Science and Culture.
Okay, now, and what is their primary objective in this intelligent design discussion and promotion? Is it actually to oppose evolutionism and promote intelligent design in the public schools, so to try to get it into the mainstream of thinking?
Yes, that's their primary purpose.
Okay, so
their primary function.
Evolutionists and intelligent designers are really in the debate about whether intelligent design can or should be, or at least the controversy should be taught in public schools.
Yes, as we said, that the Discovery Institute itself has a more widespread interest, telecommunications and other things, primarily in that Puget Sound, Seattle area. But on the other hand, this Center for Science and Culture, which is a branch of the Discovery Institute, that's where you find most of the actual and intelligent design activities taking place and promotions taking place.
All right, Ron, what is the scientific evidence of intelligence put forth by the intelligent design proponents?
There are at least four patterns of intelligent design posited by the proponents. The first one, the first pattern is called irreducible complexity. You'll hear these terms a lot if you read much intelligent design literature. And this argument claims that certain biological systems are simply too complex to have evolved naturally from simpler or less complete predecessors. Now that's called irreducible complexity.
Okay.
A second pattern is called information mechanisms. And this argument states that the information that determines the development of living things is too complex. This is now information, you see. It's too complex to evolve from non-intelligent beings, that complex organizations can't possibly be explained by unintelligent matter. Catholics would say that this would be a violation of the causation principle, that the effect can't be greater than the cause. Stephen Meyer and other prominent scientists claim that no hypothesis has been proposed that even comes close to explaining how information got into biological matter by naturalistic means. That the complexity of the information system points to design by superintelligence. And, of course, they would usually conclude that that superintelligence is God.
Okay.
Meyer is a philosopher and a scientist who is the director of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture that we mentioned a while ago. And he's a leader in the intelligent design movement.
Now, as Catholics, we certainly wouldn't have any problem agreeing with that.
No.
That there has to, everything is so complex that it... there's got to be a watchmaker if there's...
Well, this fits in perfectly with that whole philosophical, teleological argument that we looked at and that St. Thomas Aquinas had developed. They're just trying to give some scientific
foundation
to it, yes.
Okay.
A third pattern of intelligent design is called specified complexity. And this one's much more complicated, and I did a little bit of research on it last night. And it's far above my head because it gets into mathematics, complex statistical and mathematical analysis. But I didn't even understand very well the whole argument, let alone the critics and all their arguments, because it was almost all in mathematics.
Okay.
But whatever. This concept was developed by William Dembski. He's one of the leaders in the intelligent design movements. movement, and he claims that specified complexity is a reliable sign pointing to design by an intelligent agent, a central tenet to intelligent design. And he argues that complex patterns are not likely to be chance occurrences. And he says that it is impossible for specified complexity to exist in things that are formed by unguided evolutionary processes. And as a consequence, he argues that specified complex patterns found in living things points to some kind of intelligent guidance in their formation. And so I guess almost all of these intelligent design arguments can be boiled down to the idea that complex systems imply a designer.
Okay. Matt, all these, that if there's a complicated watch, there's got to be an intelligent designer, a watchmaker.
Well, just like the native that you mentioned in the first program that we had that found the watch, you know, and he concluded from that obviously this took somebody with some intelligence to design it and to build it. And of course, we're expanding that to the whole universe, that the whole universe with its magnificence and its complexity and this, that, and the other, it's just logical that it just simply is not the product of chance.
Okay.
Blind chance. And there's one final ID pattern here, and this is the fine-tuned universe. And this is one of the ones that we dealt with quite a bit in our series on reasons to believe Catholic apologetics. Sometimes this is called the anthropic principle. And this argument states that the many features that make life possible cannot be attributed to chance. That these features include such physical constants as the strength of nuclear forces, electromagnetism, electron-neutron mass ratios, gravity, and the thermodynamic concept of entropy. Intelligent design proponents argue that if any of these values were even slightly different, the universe would be substantially different than it is. They argue that many chemical elements and other features of the universe, such as galaxies, would be impossible to form unless the exact requisite features were present to achieve that particular outcome. Again, you might recall we spent quite a bit of time on that series on apologetics, looking at some of these anthropic
What
arguments.
Does anthropic mean?
Well, I think it has to do with life and life being able to develop. I think that's what it's ultimately involved with. Human scientists belittle this view. Many scientists belittle this view by saying that this argument can't be tested and that very little evidence exists to support it. Of course, you know, I think the proponents of ID could turn back and say, yeah, but a lot of your theory of evolution can't be tested either.
Okay. But I may just throw this in more as a question. Isn't it evident that there is complexity in almost anything that we look at, and that to account for it by chance would be almost unreasonable?
Well, it kind of reminds me of the story. There are a couple of two or three little stories like this, but there was one story like that if you took a chimpanzee and they give them, you know, a great big box full of thousands and thousands or millions of alphabet letters, little letters, you know, and then they would keep tossing these up in the air and tossing them up in the air and tossing them up the air, and eventually they would all fall and assemble into, let's say, one of Shakespeare's sonnets. In other words, obviously that's a kind of a blind chance kind of throw of the dice kind of thing.
Sure.
I heard another story, sort of like a junkyard. If a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and it would whirl everything up, and if you did it millions and millions, maybe billions and billions of time, that eventually everything would fall in place for a 747 jet. Obviously,
would
these
assemble
are things
itself.
That takes lots of intelligence and lots of ability, of course, to design and to build these kind of things.
So when an opponent says there isn't any evidence, doesn't the human reason balk at the chimpanzee coming up with Shakespeare, or with a whirlwind coming up with a 747 jet? I mean, isn't that some kind of visible evidence?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound logical that it couldn't have happened, with an intelligent designer.
Okay. So that's why, as Catholics, we have always held that we've got to eventually get back to an intelligent designer. No matter how much there may be true of the evolutionary process going on.
That's
right. Okay. Well, what do the opponents of intelligent design say about the intelligent design argument posited by those who defend intelligent design?
Well, keep in mind what we're talking about. We're talking about these fine-tuned universe, you know, this irreducible complexity and those kind of arguments. The opponents, which are the great majority of the scientific community, they say that intelligent design is not a science because the supernatural intervention in the origin of life cannot be tested by experimentation. It cannot generate any predictions, and it proposes no new hypotheses. Therefore, intelligent design is a pseudoscience, or in other words, a false science. It should not be taught in the public schools. Moreover, they claim that it's a religion masking as a science.
Okay.
We'll examine the validity of these criticisms of intelligent design in some future session, because we've got to build some other things before we actually get to have the ability to do that.
All right, now, this has gone to the courts, gone even up to the Supreme Court, about whether intelligent design can and should be taught in the public schools. What do legal scholars say about the teaching of intelligent design on legal and constitutional grounds so far?
Well, many legal scholars, and I'm talking primarily of professors in law schools, probably more than anything else, they maintain that intelligent design is a religious argument to prove God's existence, and to allow it to be taught in the public schools would violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which states that, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, end of quote. This is otherwise known as the Separation of Church and State Clause as well. Opponents of teaching intelligent design in the public schools claim that it is simply another version of creationism, that is intelligent design. It's just another version of creationism. And that the teaching of creationism in the public schools has been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States in the case of Edwards versus Aguilar in 1987.
Okay, since it's so important to our topic, tell us just a little bit about this decision from the Supreme Court, Edwards versus Aguilar.
Well, the case originated in Louisiana. Louisiana had a creationist act that didn't allow the teaching of evolution unless the teaching of biblical creationism was also included. The law didn't require that either be taught, as far as that's concerned. But if evolution were taught, then creationism had to also be taught as well. The case originated when a group of parents challenged the law, claiming that it violated the Establishment Clause, that is, you know, the separation of church and state.
Yet they couldn't teach creationism
right.
as well.
That it was a religious thing.
Okay.
The court agreed by a 7-2 decision. You might recall that there's 9 members on the court, and so a 7-2 decision. The majority opinion stated that, quote, the preeminent purpose of the Louisiana legislature was to advance the religious viewpoint that a supernatural being created humankind. The Louisiana Creationism Act, advocates a religious doctrine by requiring either the banishment of the theory of evolution from public school classrooms or the presentation of a religious viewpoint that rejects evolution in its entirety, end of quote.
So the Supreme Court did not allow the compromise that the Louisiana legislator had proposed.
Yes, it is.
Teaching both or don't teach
yes.
either. Okay. Well, now, you've referred a few times to creationism, that intelligent design seems to be a growth out of what has been called creationism and was banned by the Supreme Court in the Louisiana decision, Edwards and Aguilar. Can we say a little bit about creationism?
Although creationists claim that creationism is a science, as it exists today in the United States today, it is a philosophy or a theology, at least in my opinion, that the universe and all that is in it was especially designed and created by God. In some definitions, creationism refers to the belief in a literal interpretation of the Bible. especially the book of Genesis, and most especially the first 12, probably the first two chapters. The term has come down to be specifically identified with Christian fundamentalism, which rejects various aspects of the theories of evolution and cosmology. Cosmology has to do with the creation of the whole universe.
Stars, moon,
yes.
All the planets and the like.
And the science of the creationist is called creation science.
Okay, now, so what is creation science?
I used to hear a lot about that years ago. It refers to the attempts by creationists, especially those who believe in a young Earth of less than 10,000 years, to use a scientific method to support their side of the creation-evolution controversy. Creation science supporters attempt to prove that the existing scientific evidence best supports a literal interpretation of the Bible account of creation. Creation scientists are in the main members of evangelical or fundamentalist Christian denominations that subscribe to the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. In other words, the Bible tells exactly, scientifically the way
it's
things
It's a scientific
happen.
Description.
Yes.
Well, now, as Catholics, we hold that we don't have to believe in the creation narration as a scientific description of creation, although a person could if they wanted to.
Yeah, sometimes the Bible speaks allegorically, and we'll come back to that a little bit later.
Okay. Well, what position do the various Christian churches take on creationism? Because I know that, as we'll talk about a little later, as Catholics, we've got a somewhat broader view.
Well, almost all Christian churches teach that God created the cosmos, that is, you know, the whole universe. But not all of them subscribe to the strictly creationist view. Many of them take an allegorical interpretation of the creation account in the book of Genesis. And by allegory is meant a literary form that tells a story to present a truth or to enforce a moral point of view. However, most of the main advocates of creationism and intelligent design are evangelical or Pentecostal Christians. And by evangelical, I mean conservative Protestant Christians who emphasize evangelism, which means, of course, you know, preaching the gospel, spreading the gospel. It also means those who stress a personal experience of conversion. They have a highly biblical orientation. They take a literal interpretation of the Bible and believe in the importance of the Christian faith to social and cultural matters. Now, we Catholics believe most of those things, too, of course.
We would say certainly believe in the preaching of the gospel and having a personal experience of conversion and biblical orientation.
And we'd accept every one of those.
Except the one about a literal interpretation of the Bible.
Evangelicalism was made popular in the United States by preachers such as Billy Graham, and the creation of institutions such as Wheaton College, I believe it's over in Illinois if I recall right. Christianity Today is one of their leaders. It's a very good journal, I might add, is one of their leading journals. And founding of professional organizations and associations such as the National Association of Evangelicals. And they can be found in many Protestant denominations, especially Methodist and Baptist churches, and in the Reformed churches. That have a Presbyterian form of church government. And by Pentecostal Christians, I mean Protestants who believe that all Christians should try to achieve a post-conversion religious experience they call baptism with the Holy Spirit. This religious experience corresponds to the descent of the Holy Spirit on the 12 apostles at Pentecost, as told in the book of Acts of the Apostles, and is manifested by speaking in tongues, prophesying, healing, and these kind of things. Pentecostalism grew out of the 19th century holiness movement that resulted in the formation of the Free Methodist Church of North America, founded in 1860, and after World War I, the Church of the Nazarene and the Church of God. Pentecostals, they emphasize biblical literalism, conversion, moral rigor, things that we Catholics also emphasize. Roman Catholic Charismatics and certain mainstream Protestant denominations, and I mean by mainstream, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, groups like that, Lutherans, they represent this same charismatic spirit.
Okay, and the one, I suppose, exception from Catholic Charismatics, they wouldn't buy into biblical literalism in everything.
Not in everything.
Okay.
We leave it up to the church to tell us when it's meant to be taken literally.
Some of it's literal, yes. And some of it's metaphorical.
Yes.
Okay. So, and Catholic charismatics are as Catholic as anybody else.
Sure.
I mean, they're fully integrated into the church. Okay. How about the other mainline Christian churches?
Well, many contemporary Roman Catholic, Anglican, or Episcopalian in this country, and Lutheran scholars, and you probably could add a few other denominations there, tend to read much of the Bible in an allegorical sense. And by allegory, I mean a literary form that tells a story to present a truth or to enforce a moral point of view. Catholics, at least since the time of St. Augustine, have interpreted the Bible in two senses, the literal sense and the spiritual sense. And the spiritual sense is broken down further into the analogical and the tropological, or the moral, that's also the moral, and then the anagogical senses. And by anagogical is meant matters dealing with salvation and the final destination of humankind. Sometimes they're called the four last things, you know, in Catholic theology.
death, judgment,
yes.
Heaven, hell.
That's right.
Okay.
And as we shall see later in this series, this makes it easier for Catholics to accept the theory of evolution. That is because we don't necessarily always interpret the Bible literally.
Okay.
That a lot of times we know that it's meant to be taken allegorically.
Okay, now may I just throw in there that as Catholics, we want to say we must always take the Bible seriously,
yes.
But we do not need to always take it literally.
We believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, that it's always true.
Okay.
But it depends on the genre. It depends on the type. It depends on...
If it's speaking in metaphor or story
or poetic,
parable.
Or historical or whatever.
Okay. Now let's get this in because our time's running out. And it's a great saying by Cardinal Baronius.
Yes. Catholics follow the saying of Cardinal Baronius, who said in 1598 that, quote, "The Bible teaches the way to go to heaven, but not the way the heavens go," end of quote.
Okay. Now, say it again because it's a classical summary of, I think, our Catholic position.
In fact, some professor at ISU wrote a letter not too long ago in this whole intelligent design evolution debate, and he quoted that in his letter. Of course, he was taking the evolutionary point of view, but whatever. The Bible teaches the way to go to heaven, but not the way the heavens go.
Okay.
On the other hand, evangelicals and Pentecostals tend to take a more literal interpretation of the Bible, which means that they interpret the book of Genesis in a literal sense, which means they interpret the Bible as, quote, this is my quote, the way the heavens go as well as how to get to heaven.
Okay.
Instead of seeing the Bible as continuing a spiritual meaning, evangelicals and Pentecostals tend to see it essentially as a literal scientific explanation, and I maintain also historical, of the origin of the universe and all that it contains. We're working on a series on radio programs, another series, where we will at least hope to explore much more in detail the Catholic view on interpreting the Bible.
Okay, so we're talking about particularly evolutionism and the conflict between the intelligent designers, but we have so much in common with Protestant fundamentalism, actually sometimes more today with moral rigor and biblical emphasis and need to influence the country than with some other, we would say, freedom religions that have kind of fallen away. Okay, well, Ron, once again, may God bless our audience in always and in always.